From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Each day in the U.S., more than 120,000 people are waiting for an organ transplant, and another person gets added to the list every 10 minutes.
April is Donate Life Month. We'll discuss organ donation and the Mayo Clinic Transplant Center with its outgoing director.
Every day, patients may be very close to end stage of their life, and all of a sudden a donor organ becomes available. Some family has made that decision to not bury their dead one's organs, but to use those for carrying on the gift of life.
Also on the program, understanding autism spectrum disorder, and a new study on what type of exercise can help you stay young.
All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Tracy, you know, doctors at the Mayo Clinic performed the first organ transplant way back in 1963. Now, let's see. I was still in high school. You weren't even born.
Not quite,
I mean,
no.
It was a while ago, and it was done at St. Mary's Hospital right here in Rochester, Minnesota. Now, since that first transplant, which was a kidney, Mayo Clinic has actually grown into the largest integrated transplant provider in the United States. Amazing story.
Wow. Across Mayo Clinic's three campuses in Arizona, Florida, and Minnesota, more than 150 surgeons and medical doctors, plus hundreds of allied staff, are being trained every day in transplant specialties, including heart, liver, kidney, pancreas, lung, hand, face, as well as blood and bone marrow transplants.
So that younger generation is coming along. We've got to have somebody to be able to do this when Dr. Edwards and I are gone.
That's right.
You know, there's a lot going on in the world of transplant, and who better to talk about it than the director of the Mayo Clinic Transplant Center, Dr. Brooks Edwards. Dr. Edwards, great to have you back.
Good
nice to see you.
Thank you.
So you are head of a pretty big operation, it sounds like.
Well, we have here in Rochester a transplant program that does roughly 1,000 transplants a year, all different organs and blood and marrow transplant.
And how many physicians involved, both physicians and surgeons, medical doctors and surgeons?
Well, we have roughly about 15 transplant surgeons and close to 60 transplant physicians.
Pretty amazing. And what are the most common transplants that you're doing here at Mayo today?
So here, the solid organ transplants, the kidney transplant program is our largest program, and we do around 220 to 240 kidney transplants a year. We'll do about 125 liver transplants, and then we do heart, lung, pancreas, and face and hand transplants as well.
Is the kidney transplant the largest of those because of the need of people who need kidney transplants, or because you can have a living donor kidney transplant?
Well, it's a mix. Certainly, living donor kidney transplant does provide a benefit for patients in need of kidney transplant, but the number of patients waiting on the transplant list, the largest group are the kidney transplant patients. Overall, there are over 120,000 patients waiting right now in the U.S. for organ transplant, and somewhere around 60,000 of those are kidney transplant.
How can you determine if someone is a good candidate for a transplant? Because they're sick, obviously sick enough that they need to have a transplant, and I would imagine that makes it harder for them to survive a surgery like that.
Right. Well, the patients do need a good evaluation, and we look over the rest of their systems to say, are they in good shape for a transplant? And very often, if the kidney is the only organ that's failing, then they'll do very well with kidney transplant. And in fact, most patients with kidney transplant are out of the hospital on day 3 or day 4.
Pretty amazing. So tell us why there are so many kidney transplants. Why is that the most common one? Is it because the kidney is a vulnerable organ to disease? And the other interesting thing is you got two of them.
Right. Well, the kidney certainly is. It's a critically important organ. And as the kidney begins to fail, patients experience a number of symptoms. Lose their appetite, they're weak, their bone marrow also kind of falls behind things. And in our society, unfortunately, a number of things that cause kidney failure are prevalent. So hypertension, high blood pressure, is a leading cause of kidney failure. In our society, diabetes is on the increase, especially associated with the obesity crisis. As patients gain weight, they become insensitive to insulin, they develop diabetes, and one of the consequences can be kidney failure.
Would you say that's the most common reason to do a kidney transplant today is because of complications related to diabetes?
It's one of the more common reasons. There are a number of disorders. There are genetic disorders and environmental disorders that can result in kidney failure. And so diabetes is certainly a common cause, but not the only cause we see.
The liver is an interesting one because it's relatively new on the spectrum, right? I mean, you know, 30 years ago, we weren't doing liver transplants.
Right.
Why
really
now?
The infancy.
Why now?
Well, we were in the infancy of liver transplant 30 years ago, but there are a number of diseases that increasing prevalence that are resulting in liver failure. And so the things we see, again, being overweight, obese, can develop, obese patients can develop fatty liver, and fatty liver can progress into a cirrhotic liver and need transplant. Hepatitis C is now a disease that when we identify, we can treat medically, but for patients who've had long-term hepatitis C long before treatment was available, those patients gradually develop progressive liver failure, and that is also a common cause of needing a liver transplant. And unfortunately, alcohol abuse continues to be a problem in our society, and those patients can develop liver disease as well.
The situation of obesity and the effect that it ultimately has then on someone needing an organ transplant, is that adding, because that's becoming a more, the problem is increasing, is that adding people more and more to the waiting list?
So the waiting list for each organ continues to grow. It does vary. The liver waiting list has not grown dramatically over the last couple of years. Kidney transplant waiting list does continue to grow. The question of obesity and liver transplant, being obese, especially in patients who are very overweight. So if we think of a normal BMI as somebody having a body mass index around 25, many of these patients have a BMI of 40 or 45 and are oftentimes several hundred pounds overweight. You can imagine that's a very difficult operation. And our surgeons now have in a clinical study combined a liver transplant with a bariatric surgery. So at the time of liver transplant, they do a type of gastric bypass operation. And so far, that's been very successful for these highly overweight patients.
Tell us about lung transplants. How many do you do every year? How successful are they? And what are the indications?
So across the Mayo spectrum, we do lung transplants in Arizona, Florida, and Rochester. And collectively, we'll do about 60 to 70 lung transplants a year. Lung transplant is done for a number of diseases that affect the lung. COPD is a common cause. Oftentimes, that's related to smoking.
That's bronchitis or emphysema.
Bronchitis or emphysema. Other patients develop fibrosis in their lung, fibrotic lung disease.
Scarring.
Scarring of the lung, and that can require lung transplant. And then vascular problems can also occur in the lung. So patients have high blood pressure in the lung, pulmonary hypertension, and that may ultimately need a lung transplant. So it's a spectrum of diseases that bring patients to lung transplant.
All right. Well, it's good to have you with us. We're talking with the director of the Mayo Clinic Transplant Center, Dr. Brooks Edwards. Time for a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking about the importance of organ donation, clinical trials, and the ongoing transplant research at the Mayo Clinic.
And myth or matter of fact, every 10 minutes, someone is added to the national transplant waiting list. We'll find out. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Our guest is the director of the Transplant Center at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Brooks Edwards.
Myth or matter of fact, every 10 minutes, someone is added to the national transplant waiting list. Is that a myth or is that a fact?
That is a fact.
So two people added to the transplant list before the end of your interview. Wow. And there's 120,000 people right now waiting for an organ, I heard you say?
That's right. So I like to have people think of that in human terms. If you took the Rose Bowl Stadium in Pasadena and filled it, 100,000 people, you'd have 18,000 people waiting outside to get in, and they'd all need organ transplant.
The usual lung transplant, is it a double lung transplant or is it usually just a single?
It's about 50-50. In some cases, patients can do very well with a single lung transplant. For some diseases, such as cystic fibrosis, where there's a lot of infection in the lung, we would favor double lung transplant. Pulmonary hypertension, similarly.
So you've been the director of the Transplant Center now for, I think it's 8 years. What's happened over that period of time that's most impressed you?
Well,
What have you done that's really good?
Well, it has to be something that we kind of glossed over at the very beginning of this interview when we mentioned hand and face. So that has to be part of it.
Certainly, we're doing additional transplants now. So we do hand and face transplants. That's a very small niche practice. Many patients don't need transplant for facial issues or even a unilateral amputation. But there are some patients who will get tremendous benefit from that. The other thing we've done is we've worked hard to expand the availability of donors for patients waiting for transplant. So for example, in our kidney transplant program, we now have paired donation and donor chains. So if you have a donor but is not compatible with you, your donor can give to another patient and their donor can give to you. And that has accounted for about 30% of our living donor transplants in the last year.
30%?
30%.
Wow.
So that's been very beneficial for patients, and they ultimately get a better match by pairing their donors. And then in the liver transplant arena, we do living liver transplants. So if a patient is in serious need of a liver transplant, is unlikely to do well waiting for a deceased donor, they may have a living donor who would take, we would take part of their liver, about half of the liver, and use it for the recipient. The interesting thing about that is the donor, their liver grows back how fast?
6 months.
6 weeks.
No, really?
Very quickly. About 90% of the livers are regenerated in about 6 weeks.
It's incredible, isn't it? Incredible. It's the only organ that can do that.
It's our starfish.
But we have learned from interviews with Dr. Rosen that still when it would come to a liver transplant, that a deceased donor liver might be better than a living donor.
Yeah, so there are situations where a deceased donor organ may be better. There are also situations where patients may not do well waiting for a deceased donor, and if they have a living donor, it may be a preferable option.
What have you learned about when it comes to doing something as amazing as a face transplant? What have you learned about how to perform a transplant from a process such as that?
Well, I think the important thing about face transplant, or truly any transplant procedure, first of all, having an integrated team working together. So here at Mayo Clinic, physicians, surgeons, nurses, specialists in immunology and all kinds of different medical areas, infectious disease, psychiatry, and so on, all come together and bring their care to that individual patient. That integrated team is irreplaceable in terms of outcomes for transplant. The other thing we've learned is that selecting the right patients up front is critically important, and patients have to understand the issues of transplant, the downsides of transplant, the expectations that we will place on them as recipients, and if they go into it with a good understanding, they're likely to have a good outcome.
What are some of those expectations?
Well, patients after transplant will require medication lifelong. They'll be on a regimented medical routine, taking medications. They'll need follow-up, regular follow-up in a transplant center and so on. Most patients after transplant have a quick recovery. They can get back to work. They can get back to travel. They can get back to all kinds of leisure activities and family activities. But there are boundaries that they have to adhere to as
sure.
well.
All right, a couple other topics we want to cover before we finish up. And clinical trials and research. So tell us about clinical trials and how are you using them and how are they helping you in transplant surgery?
Well, if you think about the advances that have been made in transplantation, the development of new drugs to help target the immune suppression, new drugs to deal with infectious risks or complications that we may see after transplant, these all come through clinical trials. We in the heart transplant program have, I would say, pioneered the trial of a drug called sirolimus for immunosuppression that it turns out is dramatically better in preventing some of the long-term complications we would see at 5, 10, 15, and 20 years out from heart transplant.
So by immunosuppression, you mean anti-rejection drugs.
Anti-rejection drugs, right. Okay. And so having these clinical trials available and bringing the newest and best therapy available for patients has had dramatic impact on the long-term outcome for patients.
All right, what about research?
Well, there's increased opportunity now as we understand the human genome to try and create some organs that express human genes in an animal. And perhaps if we do that right, we could create an organ in a pig that would not be rejected by the recipient because it would identify it as self. Hmm. So that work is ongoing. We have people in the laboratory doing those sorts of studies to try and better identify what genes are important in the rejection phenomenon and how those could be inserted into different hosts.
What's the next frontier in transplant surgery?
In many ways, it's a iterative process. So there are small incremental improvements that may occur. Ultimately, I think we do have opportunities for biologic solutions like cell-based therapy. So if we talked about how the liver can regenerate, if we could take and rid your liver of the bad cells and repopulate it with a cellular transplant, that may be a huge game changer. We're not there yet, but there's a lot of work ongoing, and we'll see how it goes.
And at the last opportunity for you to give a plug for why people should consider becoming a donor themselves.
Well, it truly is the gift of life. Organ donation saves lives, and we see it in our practice every day. Patients who may be really very close to end stage of their life, and all of a sudden a donor organ becomes available. And some family has made that decision to not bury their dead one's organs, but to use those for carrying on the gift of life. Families find that an extraordinarily satisfying experience, and I think it often helps them in a difficult time, and clearly dramatic improvement for patients.
Dr. Brooks Edwards, congratulations on a wonderful and successful tenure as director of the Mayo Clinic Transplant Center, and thanks so much for being with us.
A pleasure.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll learn about autism spectrum disorder from a Mayo Clinic expert.
And later on the show, how high-intensity workouts might help our bodies fight the aging process. Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. It is spring break time, and many people are headed to warmer climates to get much-needed R&R and some sun, which means you could get sunburned. Sunburns can be painful, and they can increase your risk of skin cancer. So it's important to slather on the sunscreen and expose your skin to the sun gradually. But with all the different products out there, how do you know what number sun protection factor to use? 15 SPF, 50, 30+, Mayo Clinic dermatologist Dr. Dawn Davis has some recommendations.
If you'd like a little bit of sun exposure as you go on spring break, then what you can do is start off with an SPF 30 or an SPF 50 plus bottle. Apply that for the first couple of days you're there, and then gradually back down to an SPF 30 or 15.
But Dr. Davis reminds us the sun is toxic to the skin, so be sure to use that sunscreen and remember to reapply it every 2 hours and after you sweat or swim. And kids under 6 months should stay out of the sun, period. And in other news, let's talk about a hugely popular snack, popcorn. Popcorn is one of the healthiest munchies for any season, and it's easy to make. But be careful on how you prepare it to avoid excess fat and calories. Now, researchers from the University of Scranton, Pennsylvania, found the whole of the popcorn to contain polyphenols, antioxidant substances related to reduction of heart disease. It's not clear if we gain benefits from the polyphenols in popcorn as they are contained in the hull, which is insoluble fiber and not digested. There's a possibility the polyphenols pass through us unabsorbed, but it's encouraging to know that popcorn is a whole grain food and a good source of fiber. For the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Tracy, Autism Spectrum Disorder, or ASD, it refers to several developmental disorders that impair a child's ability to communicate and to interact with others. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now estimates that one out of every 68 children has autism spectrum disorder. And it doesn't seem to you like this is a condition that's much more common than it used to be?
That's what I thought. We're going to find out more today.
We'll talk to the expert.
Yes, autism spectrum disorder now includes disorders that were previously considered separate. Autism, Asperger's syndrome, pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. We got a lot of things in this category.
That's right.
Here to discuss autism spectrum disorder is Mayo Clinic psychologist, Dr. Andrea Huebner. Welcome to the program, Dr. Huebner.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Hi, Dr. Huebner. Great to have you on the program. So I realize that they have now lumped several conditions together under the term autism or autism spectrum disorder, but it just doesn't seem to me like when I was growing up that I heard much about this condition at all. And now you hear about it all the time, and the CDC says one out of every 68 children has some ASD or autism spectrum disorder. Is it more common than it used to be?
We don't think that autism spectrum disorder is actually more common than it used to be. The change has really come in different ways that we're now diagnosing. So it used to be back in the 40s and 50s when autism was first identified that we were really only talking about children who were very impaired, usually children who had significant deficits both in their social skills and communication abilities, but also usually were intellectually disabled. So they functioned in the impaired range from an intellectual standpoint. That has really changed in the last 10 to 15 years so that professionals are now diagnosing children who have much milder presentations of autism spectrum disorder. So now we're including in the spectrum children who are verbal and children who have normal intellectual ability, but they still have impairment related to some milder symptoms.
And those would be more socially noticeable than before?
Well, before these children were quite obvious. Mm-hmm. They were the children maybe who weren't speaking or were speaking very little. They might have some very unusual behaviors like rocking or hand flapping that really made them look obviously different than typical children. But now we're starting to notice that children who have much milder presentations, so they're verbal, but they have trouble with perhaps the give and take of conversation. They have trouble recognizing the meaning of eye contact or different facial expressions. So these are kids who might be going a little too far with silliness and humor, might be a bit annoying to other children, but they don't pick up on it. They might not know that different behavior is expected when you're in the library versus the grocery store versus when you're just at home with your family.
So we're just getting better at diagnosing the condition.
Right. We are identifying children who have more subtle difficulties, but are still impaired related to those difficulties. And this can really be a fine line. And we struggle with this because, of course, we don't want to overdiagnose children and apply a label that is not appropriate for them. But there are many children who have these more subtle conditions that are now being diagnosed, whereas they weren't before.
And I would assume that the milder conditions are in general diagnosed at a later time when the children are older, as opposed to the more severe form?
Absolutely. So the classic form of autism we now can diagnose as young, reliably about 2 years of age. So these are kids who are still being diagnosed as toddlers and preschoolers, but these more subtle presentations of autism, sometimes, especially since children tend to have normal intellect with that presentation, they can be 6, 7, even 9 or 10 years old. That's not common, but it does happen.
How do you diagnose these different things along the spectrum?
The standard of care for autism diagnosis is a multidisciplinary evaluation. So here at Mayo Clinic, we have a wonderful team of lots of different professionals who come together to make these diagnoses. So we have psychologists and neuropsychologists like myself who are part of the team. We also have a child psychiatrist. We have developmental behavioral pediatricians, occupational therapists, speech language therapists. We often involve our colleagues from neurology and genetics to help weigh in on these cases. We also use the support of our social workers and nursing staff. So what we do is we see these children in a week-long evaluation, and they come in and they meet with lots of different people, whoever is necessary given their particular concerns. And then at the end of the week, we come together in a team meeting, we discuss all the kids who have come through clinic, and then after that, we meet with the parents and talk about any diagnosis and treatment recommendations. So it really is a group effort.
This must be difficult for the parents when you sit down and talk with them about their child and the diagnosis.
It is difficult. These are difficult meetings, and we've talked as a team about how we can help parents and families get through this process and how we can support them on this journey. So we have modified over time the way that we give results, the length of time of our appointments. We find that, you know, often getting a first-time diagnosis of autism is very difficult news, and so parents aren't able to process a lot of information at that initial meeting, so we tend to make those brief. But then we have our nurse follow up with the family about 6 weeks after diagnosis, and then we see them at regular 3-month intervals after that in the first 6 to 9 months or so, just to make sure that they are getting the support they need and that their child is enrolled in the appropriate treatments.
How do you determine what that is? How do you go about that?
That's a really difficult question, and it's based on the child's presentation. So, for example, a child who has what we would consider classic autism, where they have significant deficits in all three areas, including language and communication, as well as social skills and restricted and repetitive behaviors, those children are usually good candidates for something called applied behavior analysis, or ABA therapy. So that's the standard of care for children who have that particular presentation. For older children who have milder presentations, we might recommend social skills groups. We might recommend accommodations through school, different outside therapies, sometimes medication, although not often. Medication can be used to treat some of the symptoms that these children have, but it doesn't take away autism. But it really is a myriad of different treatments, and each child is different.
I've heard anecdotal evidence about diet, even some that are on the milder end of the spectrum. Do you help parents with that?
Parents often have that question. So in autism, I suppose, as in other areas of medicine as well, there are what are considered kind of the core standard treatments, but then there are also what might be considered more experimental treatments. Diet is something that people often ask about because it's within parents' control. Sure. And parents at this stage are often really eager to find anything that will help. Anecdotally, parents will say that a diet change, like a gluten-free, casein-free diet, or omitting certain dyes from a diet is helpful for their child. But when we look at the group evidence, there's really no evidence to suggest that those things make a significant difference for children on the spectrum.
Okay, save the most difficult question for last. What causes this, and is there any evidence that childhood vaccinations have anything to do with the development of autism?
So the cause of autism is unknown. We know that there's something genetic that's going on with these children, but we also know that there's an environmental component as well that we do not fully understand. Because the range and spectrum of autism is so broad, there are many candidate genes that have been implicated. So if we look at the genetic markers for these children, they vary considerably. There are a few that tend to be more pronounced that we see more often, but there's something like 700 candidate genes where we see differences in children with autism. So we really have a long way to go in terms of understanding the genetic basis. We also know, though, that there's something environmental, because when we do twin studies of monozygotic twins who have the same DNA, it's not uncommon to have one twin with autism and the other one to not be affected. So we know that there's something else environmental, and there have been lots of theories put forth about what that could be: maternal illness during pregnancy, age of parents, something environmental that's kind of unknown, but we don't have the answer to that question just yet.
You know, hopefully someday you'll figure it out, because there are a lot of people who would like to get the answer to that question. And thanks so much for filling us in and about autism spectrum disorder. You've been most helpful. Psychologist Dr. Andrea Huebner, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll find out how high-intensity interval training might reverse the effects of aging.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Tracy, we all know that exercise is good for you, but the other question is, what kind of exercise, what type of training helps most, especially when you're older, say over 65? Now, that's a little bit discriminatory, isn't it? with people over 65, they're seasoned citizens.
Right.
Well, a recent Mayo Clinic study says that the best exercise is high-intensity aerobic exercise.
While it's not exactly the fountain of youth, exercise, particularly high-intensity interval training, encourages your cells to make more proteins to feed their energy needs, which can actually reverse some of the aging process at the cellular level, Dr. Shives.
It all has to do with your cells? I don't quite get it. We need to talk to somebody who knows.
Here to discuss is the senior researcher on this study, Mayo Clinic endocrinologist Dr. Sri Nair. Welcome to the program, Dr. Nair. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Nair, it is really good to have you on the program, because this is an intriguing study that you did suggesting that you can actually, well, maybe reverse the aging process. But you're an endocrinologist. You're a hormone doctor. How is it that you got interested in exercise?
Well, I'm a predominantly a diabetologist,
treat patients with diabetes. Okay.
And one thing we realized pretty early is that you can improve insulin sensitivity or insulin action that may prevent onset of diabetes in many people. There are studies showing that exercise alone, people who are high predisposition to become diabetic, diabetes can be delayed or even prevented by an exercise program. And another one is, of course, a caloric restriction. They are the two things which have been shown to really delay the onset of diabetes.
And exercise and diet. Exercise diet, exactly. and keeping your weight under control.
That's right.
You can either delay it or prevent it.
That's
diabetes.
That's right. Another reason why I'm interested in exercise is we know that even if you have a family history of diabetes, genetic predisposition to become diabetic, most people don't become diabetic until they become older. So one of the other things we realized pretty early is almost 65% of the sugar after a mixed meal is metabolized by the muscle. And we realized that with age, you decline your muscle mass. And we also found many years ago, with age, there is also a decline of your capacity to convert nutrient energy to a chemical energy called adenosine triphosphate, ATP. That's the only form of energy cell can use it. So the organelle for doing that is called mitochondria. Then mitochondria decline with the age, and which means overall your energy requiring processes also decline. So we realize that's one of the key things happening with aging. And our early cross-sectional studies have shown that when you compare with the people who regularly exercise vigorously for a long period, more than 4 years, young and old people, when you compare them with the people who are sedentary, we found that most of these changes we are seeing in people who are sedentary older people can be almost completely reversed by this exercise program in older people.
Wow.
So that really, especially in mitochondria and insulin sensitivity, insulin sensitivity also declined with the age. that can predispose to diabetes.
Yeah, pretty amazing. But you also suggested that maybe if you had more muscle, since 65% of sugar is metabolized in the muscle, that that would be a part of the regimen too.
Yeah, I think increasing muscle mass, but muscle also has to be metabolically active. That means you can prevent muscle loss by resistance exercise, but that improves the insulin sensitivity. But that doesn't stimulate, based on our recent study, that doesn't stimulate the ability of this mitochondria, which is a sort of organelle within the cell, converting my nutrient energy to ATP.
All right, so in order to do that, that's exercise.
That's aerobic exercise. Among the aerobic exercise, this current study we did, we want to understand what's happening at the cellular level. And so that way we compared high intensity interval training. That means you cannot do very high intensity continuously for a long period. So there is a period, interval of high intensity. Then you go down and do a low intensity. Then you go back to high intensity. So that's called interval training.
You go all out for a while and then you slow down.
Yeah, if you can, you know, there are various regimes of high intensity interval training. What we followed is only 15, 16 minutes of the total exercise period. These people did high intensity by biking. The rest of the period was a low intensity. And this was under supervision. We made sure that everybody did the right way. And what we found was this is associated with almost 67-69% increase of the capacity to produce ATP by the mitochondria in the muscle by older people. Almost 47-48% by younger people.
So then that means that you can metabolize the sugar? Is that?
Well, you know, it's also, you know, even if you burn a fuel, you'd have to convert that energy into ATP. We have found that if you are insulin resistant, like women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, they are very severely insulin resistant. And as a result, they can predispose diabetes, heart disease, various problems. And those people, we found that even they are burning fuel, there's an inefficiency converting that into ATP. And what we found in the study is that, women with the PCOS, you can correct that by exercise program. So this study, we found that this capacity to produce ATP substantially increased in older people, which was lower to begin with. And that occurred because any gene expression is through proteins. And what we found was that the mitochondrial protein, it was lower in older people. That returned to pretty high level after exercise. And that's explained this increase in the capacity to produce ATP.
Should the high intensity interval training be, is that the best exercise for people over 65?
Well, we have to be careful about that. The point is somebody who's sedentary, they cannot really start a high intensity interval training. So older people, best advice is first they have to talk to your doctor. How can I start doing an exercise program? Slowly and steadily increasing. And preferably, if they can go to a fitness center, get some instruction from an exercise physiologist, then they can do by themselves.
You got to check with your physician first. High intensity exercise gets your heart rate up pretty high.
Very high. That's the reason. I think that way, start slowly and steadily increasing.
So what you have done is figured out actually on a cellular level what it is about exercise that it is so good. And you've also figured out that the high intensity is better than just medium intensity.
And do 3 days a week high intensity interval training. 2 days may do the resistance training. The other 2 days do a modest walking or something. Do something every day. The worst thing that happen is
not doing anything.
Not doing it sedentary.
All right, we got to run back to the office, huh? Dr. Sri Nair, high-intensity interval training. He's an endocrinologist at the Mayo Clinic. Great study. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
And that's our program for this week.
Find more information on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Tweet your health and medicine questions to #MayoClinicRadio.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.